Let me just begin straight away, if I could, to welcome you all to this, what will be our last meeting for a period, and not for very long, because no doubt we'll be having something by September, in our IDEAS alumni network. The purpose of this alumni network is to integrate and pull back in and hopefully utilize the talents of our alumni. These are the alumni who are on our executive masters. And now we're moving into our sixth year next year, but also we'd like to invite other people to this as well. And this is one of our initiatives within LSE IDEAS to develop debate, discussion on the major issues of the day. And I'm delighted to welcome this morning my old friend on the far side there, Jamie Shea, I'm sure needs no introduction, has been working for NATO since 1949, I think. Isn't
it? Yeah, I arrived a year before.
Yeah, I thought he was present at creation, I think, but he never gets any older, I noticed that as well. And secondly, Anne Applebaum, who again needs no introduction, but we were delighted. Anne was a Philip Remont chair here in IDEAS. We had several of these debates, and they take the normal form. We get the speakers to speak for about 10, 15 minutes, and then we'll open it up for Q&A, and we'll try and finish us right on time if we can, about 9:35. If I could begin with Jamie, if that's okay. Jamie, is that okay?
Absolutely.
So, Jamie, over to you, and thank you again for coming, and to you too, Anne, as well. Thank you.
Okay, Mick, as I've only got 10 minutes, I'll dispense with the classic jokes,
which normally take up at least
8 of the minutes. But sincerely, thank you very much, of course, for inviting me and giving me a chance to escape, if only for a couple of hours, the Brussels bubble, which is even more bubbly today than normal, of course, with the summit going on. Secondly, I feel rather intimidated because I see so many foreign policy heavyweights around the table. I'm really just, unfortunately, a physical heavyweight these days. And therefore, I feel, to again use a very well-known joke, rather like the seventh husband of Elizabeth Taylor, who knows what he has to do on the wedding night but doesn't know if he can make it interesting. But no doubt we'll have a good discussion. Okay, a few kick-off points. As I was on the Eurostar late last night and thinking what to say, I thought probably I'd sort of divide my remarks inevitably 50% between some quick ideas, thoughts on the Brexit debate, which of course is overwhelming everything at the moment, and second topic, the Warsaw Summit, which is just now about 1 week away. It kicks off Friday of next week. On Brexit, just some quick thoughts. I mean, my first thought is that the US clearly is going to have to return to its traditional role as the European balancer, the European pacifier. I was reading an article by Stephen Walter, again on Eurostar last night, and he came up with a phrase that really grabbed me. He said that, Europeans now not only have to fear Putin, but they have to fear Europe as well. Europe is now, unfortunately, become a sort of a supplier of fear, of uncertainty, and no need to go into the reasons for that. It was quite significant that John Kerry was over here and in Brussels at NATO headquarters, of course, at the beginning of the week, and we can all debate, whether a Trump administration would want or be able to perform this role. I think we can feel more certain that a Clinton administration would see the need, but clearly, it's not just going to be enough for the US to provide reassurance to Poland or the Baltic states with battalion forces or pre-positioned equipment or the President's European Reassurance Initiative. We're going to have the US deeply involved with Germany, with France, with the UK in helping us to stitch ourselves back together. Consequences, of course, for the pivot to Asia, consequences for the Middle East. Can we make it appetizing for the US to engage in this effort through, for example, a TTIP type of initiative? But clearly, I think that's one area, no time today to go into the details, that we are going to have to sort of go back to the future. Secondly, we need, obviously, with the Brexit, an orderly process. The President, Obama, has stressed this. Kerry stressed this very much. The divorce is going to be messy. Let it not be bloody if we can avoid it. Of course, to my mind, this means doing it not only in a way that minimises the constant sort of sucking in of energy in Brussels, as the British issue takes away time away from discussing Putin, Ukraine, what to do with the states in between, what to do with the Balkans, what to do with the Middle East. I think given the massive nature of these issues, it would be a tragedy if the EU started turning inward. But the second aspect of an orderly divorce is, of course, to do it in such a way that remarriage is an early possibility, if that's the way that both sides want to take, and maybe a second referendum. I'm sure we'll debate this. And that means, to my mind, at least both sides reaching out to each other. For example, keeping the Brits in the CSDP, where we have an obvious interest in the Central Mediterranean, in the Aegean, like we had in Piracy, where the UK commanded the operation for the first time, in the way that Norway or Turkey or Canada participate in the CSDP operations. The intelligence cooperation, keeping the UK involved in regional frameworks, already very strong with the Nordics, with the Dutch, with the amphibious brigade, with, of course, France, the Lancaster House business. I'm not suggesting any of this will be easy or automatic, but the UK has been quite in favour of European defence in these regional frameworks, and we should not allow that to unravel as well. The third issue, by the way, just can I add on that, on the orderly divorce side, clearly we've also now got, with Mogherini's global strategy paper being presented in Brussels today, a sort of good news but also a challenge. The good news is the recognition of NATO and the NATO-EU partnership. The not so much bad news, I wouldn't put it that way, particularly from me, a fan of European integration. But of course, if France and Germany now go off towards, to put it in sort of rather sort of caricatural terms, the European army approach. I mean, I don't believe that the European army is on the cards, but, you know, the operational headquarters, the very close integration, the European strategic autonomy from NATO, lots of committees and command structures in Brussels. Of course, we would then get back into the duplication debate, and again, it would be less palatable for the UK to re-engage. So we have to see how we handle that, while recognising that France and Germany, in the wake of Brexit, see defence integration in Europe as the new way of relancer the European project. Final issue on Brexit, very briefly, Mick, and then a couple of words on the NATO summit. The UK may not be in the EU, at least for the time being, but it will be in NATO. So to what degree can we use NATO to do some of the old EU business? You know, many of us who have been around NATO have had this dream for years of using NATO in a more political way as a transatlantic consultative forum, but frankly, it's never really happened, and we all know the reasons why. The Europeans have wanted to use the EU, the United States to some degree too. But with Britain now sort of on the outside, could NATO be more politically active in discussing the big strategic issues? And we, of course, will need to use NATO to reconstruct a transatlantic narrative, because the Brexit debate, of course, is focused on the EU narrative. We like it or we don't. But the populist parties, you know, the Front National, Geert Wilders and the others, you know, the Five Star Movement in Italy, they're just as anti-American as they're anti-EU. And many of them are very pro-Putin, as we know. You've heard Nigel Farage on this subject. So there is a need, clearly, as we try to go back to the liberal democratic order, to not just to reconstruct a European narrative, but a transatlantic narrative, and to what extent can NATO help in that respect? A couple of words on the summit. Just the three things to look for. The first of all, of course, in the area of defence and deterrence, is to say that we've implemented the decisions that we took in Wales to provide an effective defence and deterrence force in Central and Eastern Europe, and to reverse the decline in defence budget. 17 allies are now spending more on defence. Nine are moving within the next 5 to 10 years towards 2%. Before Wales, only five were spending 20% of their budgets on new equipment. Now it's nine. It could be better. Of course it could be better. And we still have five allies below 1%. But in the main, this 2% defence pledge has helped to put things back on a more positive direction. The second issue, of course, is that Wales has been the starting point, but given the challenge that we now face from Russian assertion in the east, Wales is not enough. So as you can see, the Warsaw will decide on enhancements in the form of four battalions with other pre-positioned equipment, new headquarters being established on the territory of the Baltic states and Poland. And we're still looking, hopefully Canada will step up, for a command for the 4th Battalion by next week so that we can announce a concrete timetable. These will not just be national, they'll be multinational. The key challenge will be to sustain its presence for probably some time to come. Now, there are going to be some big issues, and I don't have time to map them out now, but just to flag them up briefly. The first one is, does this really deter Putin, and how do we know? We don't want to under-deter, but given our financial situation and the need to avoid a kind of Anglo-German arms race a la 19th century, we don't want to over-deter either. Can we, therefore, not just deter, but to use this NATO response over the last 2 years to negotiate with the Russians? I don't mean negotiate some kind of carve-up of Eastern Europe, God forbid, but I mean negotiate some kind of stability regime based on arms control, you know, the CFE treaty, transparency measures, things that avoid, you know, the Turkish-Russian aircraft incident of a few months back. There's a lot of interest in Brussels. So, you know, will this posture help us with deterrence, but will it also help us with détente? This is going to be the first point. The second point is dealing with the issue of anti-access area denial. We've still, notwithstanding this presence in Eastern Europe, we're still relying essentially on an early warning, mobilise the troops, get them into the theatre, reinforcement strategy. But if we can't do it because of this Russian very complex air defence, a jamming type of system in the Baltics, in Eastern Europe, we won't get our troops there on time. To what extent will the United States be ready to lend NATO some of its highfalutin so-called third offset strategy capabilities, stealth and so on, to help us overcome that? The next issue is very briefly hybrid. We are very much in NATO geared to a classical military attack with a classical military response, but we all know, of course, that the way in which Russia has tried to exert its power has been more through these sort of cyber attacks, you know, sabotage, media campaigns. Anne, of course, knows a lot about this type of thing. You know, how do we deal effectively sort of with that, the so-called phase zero? Because the danger is if NATO waits for the duck to quack like a duck, move like a duck, look like a duck, act like a duck, in military terms, it's too late. And this brings me to my final, my key point about this. We all know, and Richard Sheriff in his book has pointed to this, the BBC TV programme has pointed to it, Ben Hodges, our Landsat commander in Europe, has pointed to it. It's difficult to defend the Baltic states. Not impossible, and we have to do it, but it's difficult given the imbalance of power locally. So how do we compensate for that in NATO by what you call full spectrum deterrence, opening up other fronts, for instance, where we may be in a better position, using all of our economic and other instruments? You know, if we can't deter Russia as such purely through the balance of forces in theatre, how do we then turn the tables in a way that makes us stronger? To put it in a nutshell, you know, I get the impression Russia is able to do a lot with little, and we sometimes do a little with a lot. So how do we integrate our various power components in a way that gives us greater deterrent value beyond the simple sort of tripwire in Eastern Europe? Finally, Mick, and then I'll stop, the last part is Project Stability, which is the South. Of course, the incoherence in the EU is not good news for us in this respect because, of course, the South is not a linear threat with a linear response. You all know this. It's extremely complex, a range of different instruments, where, of course, the EU, with its defence capacity building, its police, you know, its judiciary, its sort of migration, dealing with migration issues, is our natural partner. And like in hybrid war, we have hitched our wagon to the European Union, and therefore we can't afford, for the success of NATO, to have a dysfunctional Europe. Issues here are AWACS aircraft being given to the coalition next week to support the campaign against ISIL, a possible NATO role in the central Mediterranean, to try to help the EU with Libya, with the migration crisis, a continuation of the mission in Afghanistan, where clearly we need to stay longer than we would have hoped, and trying to ramp up our partnerships with the countries of the region. Some are good. Jordan, Iraq, we'll be going back to Baghdad. The Iraqis have asked us to do that. I think the summit will decide to do that. But other partnerships, Algeria, Egypt, are not so good. Saudi Arabia, And so how can we become an effective actor? As you all know, and this will be my final point, although many allies look to the east, quite a large number believe that the real threats are very much from the south, and their sort of support for doing things in Eastern Europe, particularly this long-term sustainable presence, will be very much geared to the willingness of others, like Poland, which has just sent F-16s down to Iraq, and trainers, or the Estonians, who have sent some troops off to the Central African Republic to help the French. Their support for the East will be geared to the quid pro quo of having allies willing to invest also in the South as well. So that is essentially a little bit of the scene that we face at the moment. From an intellectual point of view, it's probably a fantastic time to be alive, because there are so many awesome strategic issues, but from a policymaker's view, it's absolutely hell.
And on that note, we'll end. Anne, over to you. Thanks very much, Jamie.
Thank you. Jamie has just done such a broad and comprehensive sort of glance at all the major issues that I think what I will do instead is concentrate a little bit on just on Russia. I have to say, coming over here this morning, I suddenly blinked and woke up, and I thought, wait, I have to go back from Brexit back to Russia, and it it was disorienting. But I think the important thing to remember that there's an enormous difference right now, and as Jamie said at the end of his remarks, between us and the Russians. And the difference is that the Russians have a strategy towards the West, and the West does not have a strategy towards Russia. And there are good reasons why we don't have a strategy towards Russia, as I'll explain. But it's important, but one of our problems is that it's taken us a long time to wake up and understand what it is that Russia wants, what is Russia doing in the West. We've invented this expression, hybrid warfare, but we haven't really spent a lot of time trying to understand what it is and how it works. Russia has a strategy towards NATO, and Russia's strategy towards NATO is to persuade NATO's weakest members that they cannot be defended, and to intimidate NATO members into giving up before there's a war. So I don't think Russia is interested in invading the Baltic states, and I doubt very much they want a full-scale, operational war with NATO. But they are very, very interested in convincing NATO members and also people on the borders of NATO that they wouldn't stand a chance, and by intimidating them, persuade them to lose faith in the organization, lose faith in the institution, lose faith in European institutions, and possibly create openings for Russia politically and economically. The examples of this we've seen over the last, couple of months and years include conducting military exercises when Russia runs military exercises, as Jamie knows, what they do is they stage an imaginary invasion of the Baltic states. And they stage they have practiced a nuclear bombardment of Warsaw. We know this is what they do. The Poles know this is what they do. The Balts know this is what they do. And they do it in order to say, look, this is what we're exercising. This is what we're practicing. They've staged a number of events around Sweden on the Swedish coast. They've used planes to buzz Sweden, the Swedish airspace. There have been this one or two odd submarine incidents. I've never gotten to the bottom of understanding exactly what happened, but they seem to be sending submarines into Swedish waters in order to frighten the Swedish Navy. Sometimes they've done things like entered Danish airspace, over a holiday weekend, just to see how fast the Danes could scramble their planes to respond back. They've come close to British airspace as well. In the Baltic states, the intimidation tactics are in both internal and external. They've included kidnapping an Estonian security officer from the Estonian side of the border into Russia. They include the funding of pro-Russian political parties inside Latvia and Lithuania. That's the military piece of it. But again, the point is that when we say hybrid war, we don't mean we don't just mean that they're using different tactics. There is a strategy, and the strategy is to win the war before you fight it. In the rest of Europe, the strategy is broader. It's very ambitious. It's so ambitious that it sounds ludicrous. You know, and probably it can't work, but, you know, as just because something can't work doesn't mean you can't do a lot of damage trying to make it happen. As you can see, you know, the international communist movement was also wanted to, you know, conquer the world, and it didn't succeed, but it did a lot of damage along the way. What is the Russian strategy? The Russian strategy is to break up the European Union and undermine NATO and make better openings for Russia politically and economically in Europe. How does the strategy work? Well, again, it works through funding anti-EU political parties in Europe. I mean, and I should stress that, as we've just seen in the last few days, much of what Russia does is not inventing things. It's not in the olden days where the Russians would invent a communist party and put its leaders into a country and then, you know, hope that it took off. What Russia does is it funds existing fissures. It actually has a strategy that goes country by country. It funds the National Front in France. It funds Jobbik in Hungary. It does deals with Viktor Orban in Hungary. It funds a massive information operation, you know, trolling, social media, designed to undermine status quo parties, mainstream media, and pro-European parties. Again, whether it makes a difference, I doubt very much that Russia had any influence or role of any significance in the Brexit debate. I didn't see it there. UK is a big country with strong media and, you know, large civil society and, you know, the BBC. Those kinds of tactics do work in much smaller countries. They've been very successful in the Czech Republic, where they helped elect a pro-Russian Czech president. I think they were successful in Poland, where they helped undermine the previous government and put in place a far-right government, which is, although anti-Russian, is far less credible as a partner for the West. And that, you know, that's their strategy. As I say, it doesn't cost very much. It doesn't cost very much to hire 1,000 internet trolls. It doesn't cost, you know, that much to buzz the Swedish coast and, you know, frighten people. But it's a consistent and constant effort to undermine Western institutions. Of course, it has a foreign policy component. It also has a domestic component. It's very important for Putin to show his people that there is no alternative. In other words, that, okay, there are, you know, the Russian regime might be corrupt and you might not like it and you might not like the way it works, but look, everything in the West is bad and getting worse. You know, it's exactly the same. What is our response to it? What is our response? We can't have the same kind of response, or we find it very difficult. You know, paradoxically, Russia is both a very weak country and a very, you know, simultaneously, I would say, Putin is very strong and very weak. So he's weak in the sense that his economy is nothing like ours. His power is, he's not recognized as legitimate by everybody. He has people around him who would probably like him to go. But he's strong in the sense that he has more control over the different elements of his society than is even thinkable in any one of our societies. So he controls, you know, it's as if President Obama controlled the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, Fox News, plus, you know, General Motors, Google, Apple, and, you know, the CIA, the FBI, Congress, and I don't know what else.
That's enough.
The trade unions. He has the control over those institutions in his society, and in our societies, those institutions are divided from one another. So there's no U.S. president who can say, right, we're going to have a mass trolling operation which is designed to, you know, as you said, create a narrative and bring the West together. You know, it's not going to happen like that. Since we're talking about the NATO summit, is there a NATO strategy? There's certainly more of one than there was 2 or 3 years ago. The NATO deterrent, I think, is important, and one of the reasons why there's been such a strong Russian reaction to it is that it's really the first time NATO's come together in a significant way in recent years. NATO has recognized that it needs an information strategy, although I don't think it yet has got an idea what that should be. It's doing better at communications, but it doesn't have a counter strategy for Russian trolling. Cybersecurity, that's mostly being done, as I understand it, you know, country by country. And NATO itself doesn't really yet see its role or doesn't understand what its role is. You know, what can the role of Europe be? You know, I've thought over the last couple of days, you know, what would be the, and I'll stop here because I see that it's already 9 o'clock. I thought over the last couple of days, what would be the correct European response to Brexit? And I think, you know, paradoxically, to me, what would make the most sense is a kind of dual response, which is, on the one hand, unifying around some security issues, creating a naval force that could blockade the Libyan coast, for example, and prevent migrants from getting in boats and dying, showing that it's in control of the diplomatic and security situation. I mean, I don't even dare ask for more than that because I know that that's probably already asking a lot. Taking control of the immigration issue in profound ways. And I would actually welcome a French and German defense force. And I think actually it's time that people in this country began to see that if that's the way that we're going to get more military spending and more defense involvement from the Germans and the French, then we should be in favor of it. And at the same time, I would hope that Europe would begin to disengage economically and deregulate and have less economic involvement and sort of let states have more power. But the, you know, one of the things that we can do just to begin to think about countering Russia, and I haven't even spoken about terrorism, is to begin thinking about how to bring Germany into this in a way that makes sense.
Okay, yeah. Thanks very much, Anne. That leaves us plenty of time for Q&A. Could I just start with one quick question? We talked about confronting Putin, now surviving Brexit. Could you say something about Trump? I've never been to a meeting over the last 4 months without Trump being number one. What do you feel his attitudes are towards NATO, to what's going on? It seems he came out with a pretty clear endorsement of the Brexit vote, as far as I could see. That's what he said when he was in Scotland. They let him in, I noticed.
Yeah, until he realised that the Scots hadn't voted for it.
Yeah, then he said, these damn Scots, yeah. Could you just say something about what you think is happening on the other side of the Atlantic?
There isn't that much to say because Trump has no, you know, unlike any other presidential candidate in modern history, he has no foreign policy advisors, he has no foreign policy program. He made a completely incoherent speech, which... I mean, I won't bother to dissect it, but it made no sense. The one thing we do know, and he's been very consistent about actually over many years, including in books that he's written, you know, 5 and 7 years ago, is that he doesn't like NATO, and he thinks that spending on NATO is a waste of money. And he said that repeatedly. That's actually not a new. That's not a new populist. You know, that's not a vote-getting comment. That's something he said before. So we do have in the U.S. election a choice between. One candidate who is clearly committed to NATO and clearly committed to Europe, for all whatever her many other faults might be, she believes in allies and alliances and so on. With Trump, there's really no guarantee.
Okay. Jamie, do you want
to? Just to add, I mean, Anne, of course, totally agree. But I also have to point out that Trump is not alone, though, in the United States in sort of reflecting this sort of growing American impatience on burden sharing. When Stoltenberg was in Washington recently, he ran into quite a lot of flack on Capitol Hill, also from the Democrats, also from people in the Hillary campaign on this. The U.S. is now spending just over 70% of the totality of the NATO defense budgets at a time when, of course, its own defense budget has been under strain. And although, you know, we very much greet the European reassurance program, the $3.4 billion that Obama has given, which I referred to, we also have to remember that this does not mean 320,000 American troops and 7,000 tactical nuclear weapons, you know, coming back to Europe as we had during the Cold War. I'm not arguing, by the way, that this is what we need, of course not. But what I am pointing out is that, you know, the American presence will be significant, but it will not by itself, vis-a-vis the Cold War, be able to carry the burden of military deterrence. The Europeans are going to have to do far more, not just in the Mediterranean, because there's been this kind of sense, you know, leave the East to the Americans and we Europeans will do the soft stuff in the Mediterranean and capacity building, but there'll have to be some sort of European deterrence component in the East as well. The UK, of course, has taken on a role here, so has Germany, which obviously means, you know, the UK post-Brexit is going to have a good dialogue with the Europeans, if only on this in terms of sustaining these multinational formations over the over the long run. So, you know, although I agree that the Clinton administration would be better for this kind of American re-engagement that I mentioned, the burden-sharing issue is not going to go away.
Okay, now, and also there's a wider question, how strong you feel the transatlantic relationship will be if TTIP fails, but that's another issue, of course. Let's begin. If people would just put their hands up and just introduce yourself. I think, Tamila, you...